Well, then I'll make it official. The next matter on for oral argument this morning is in re the Carmen Start Revocable Trust and the Thelman Start Revocable Trust. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. Those timing restrictions are indicated in the light and clock in the lectern. And the lectern has a little button in front, so you can raise or lower it to match your height at your convenience. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument, because we keep only an audio recording of the presentation today for the benefit of the public. Counsel, whenever you are ready to proceed, appellant's counsel may do so.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Eric Hansen. I represent the appellant in this matter, Sydney Start. The case before the court is a dispute regarding a trust between the Start Revocable Trust and litigation that spawned. There are three issues that I want to speak to the court about today. I wanted to start with the first one, which has to do with an appraisal of the property in Florida. And I think the court has an understanding of the background, but one of the trust assets that was here was a property in Florida. And as part of the estate, there was an option agreement that allowed the renter to buy that property and deduct basically the rent payments from the purchase price. The renter at that time was the appellant in this matter. And what we have here is a finding by the district court that that option was properly exercised and was deliberately thwarted by the other beneficiary. I'll try not to refer to them both as Start because that's a little confusing, but I'll use respondent for purposes of clarity. The evidence.
I understand the argument that, you know, it didn't close in 7 months and they should have, you know, used the first appraisal because that was in the 7 months, but, you know, doesn't a trustee have an obligation to you know, get as much money as possible for the trust before the distributions take place?
I would say under the circumstances, no, because this was an equal trust, and whether in an ordinary
case,
if the
price goes up, everybody gets more under a 50-50 split, right?
That's true. I will concede that point. But when you're talking about equitable distribution of assets between family members, I don't think that increasing the value of the asset to be distributed, and the purpose of the trust is not to maximize distributions. The purpose of the trust is to equitably divide the property between the children. And so I understand the court's point, but I think that it is equally valid to look at it and say that what was being done here was a deliberate attempt, especially after Sydney started indicated that she intended to purchase the property. There was a deliberate attempt to drive the price up to essentially reduce her distribution out of the trust. And realistically, that's exactly what we got here. Basically, with the district court signing on to the second appraisal, not only do we get delayed.
Judge Connolly's question, though, isn't there a duty to figure out what the actual fair market value of the property is? I understand the argument about driving a price up for the sake of driving it up, but in terms of trying to achieve an equitable distribution, they need the accurate value of that property, because one way it increases one person's share and the other way it increases the other person's share. So why wasn't getting the second appraisal within the scope of the responsibilities and the duty to, in fact, determine what the proper value was?
And I think the key point and answer to your question is that the timing mattered. The option contract provided for a period of time
But the option contract didn't have any language in it that said that the appraisal had to occur within the 7 months. Is that correct?
Did it have specific language that said you have to have an appraisal? No. It said you had to have it sold for fair market value. So then the question is, what's fair market value? And we had an appraisal. There was an appraisal. It was obtained during the option period, and it laid out a number that I would submit was fair market value.
Well, was there any duty of the trustee to rely upon that appraisal? I guess that's my question. In the trust itself, is there any mechanism requiring the valuation process?
Not other than the broad language about obligations being owed by the trustee to act in good faith.
I mean, the trustee could have, presumably in good faith, just said, you know, I've looked at the market data. We don't need an appraisal at all. Here's what I think is the fair market value. There's no, would you agree there's no obligation expressly in, or even implicitly, that an appraisal is necessary before the sale occurs?
I would agree with that. I think that the trustee could have said, nope, I think it's $1 million, and pulled that number out of thin air, and there would have been a dispute then as to whether or not that's reasonable or not.
Right.
But that's not our scenario here.
Right, so aren't we, I guess what I'm getting at is, aren't we just looking at a certain area that is within the discretion of the trustee, recognizing perhaps some competing duties here? You've got the fiduciary duty. You've got to value the asset. It's got to be fair. There's a timing element. There's a sense that we want to have the thing as
right.
high value as reasonable. Those seem to be there's somewhat tension between those competing obligations.
I agree that there is tension, and I think that what decides it in this case is the district court's express finding that the respondent deliberately delayed transferring the Florida property. And as part of that finding, found that the second appraisal happened outside of the time period that the trust was supposed to have transferred this to Sidney Stark. And so I think ultimately when we look at this and think about it, as you're correct, there are these tensions, these duties. What we have as a practical matter here is the district court ultimately awarding inequitable behavior on the part of the respondent. Basically, she's being awarded, and Sidney Stark is being punished to the tune of $400,000.
Well, it just so happens that it turned out that way. I mean, what if the appraisal had come in lower? The second appraisal.
I think that we wouldn't have this dispute.
Or we'd be sitting at different sides of the podium.
I think that the answer, you still have the timing problem here. That I don't think that it is enough to say, okay, well, maybe it could have come back at a lower number, could have come back at $500,000, and that would have remedied it.
I guess that's the difficulty I'm having. So if I'm sitting in the trustee's shoes, I'm thinking, okay, I there's this timing element. There seems, you know, that this is a, we want to, there's something in the trust that would suggest timing is of the essence, but there's also an obligation to make sure that the valuation is accurate.
Correct.
And if the trustee is in a situation where at this moment in time valuation is uncertain, why is choosing timing over accuracy a requirement?
I think that it has to do with the language of the trust, because the trust imposed a 7-month window. That was a defined term for that option. And then imposed a general obligation of reasonable value. There was evidence of reasonable value. It's not like Sidney Stark said, hey, I'll pay you $10 for the Florida property, and I think that's reasonable, and the respondent had to accept that. This was presented with an appraisal. Somebody outside, no connections to Ms. Stark, who went through and said, based on these factors, here's where I come up with this number from. And when the district court is looking at this basically after the fact, I think that the district court erred in not recognizing that we get to the second appraisal only because of the unclean hands on the part of the respondent, that the only reason this higher number is out there is because after the fact, after she decided she wasn't going to let her exercise the option, then she sought a justification for her refusal to do what the trust documents obligated her to do. And so I think when we think about this in equity, which I think is what the district court has to do in handling this trust, to see one of the trustees engage in an inequitable act and then be rewarded for it, I think that's error. And I think that is something where this court should say, you know, yes, district court, you have substantial discretion on these matters, but it's not unfettered discretion. It's important that you consider and weigh these factors. And one of them here is clearly respondents' inequitable conduct. And it resulted in a cost to Sydney Starr of $400,000, and the district court already found that that was deliberate. So I think for the district court then to put together an order and ignore that first appraisal and latch onto the second appraisal is problematic. I think it's especially problematic, and I won't belabor it here at argument, but we laid out in our brief a number of things wrong with that second appraisal. You know, whether that went to the expertise of the appraiser, the district court latched onto a general disclaimer in the first appraisal regarding pest control and knowledge of building standards and that sort of thing. And so, well, this first appraiser is disclaiming their appraisal. That's just factually inaccurate.
On your unclean hands argument, the district court did not assess it didn't expressly refer to unclean hands theory. When was it first presented to the district court that unclean hands was a basis for the district court's decision, contrary to its decision? Or was it presented precisely?
I believe it. It certainly was presented as inequitable conduct. If I can point to a post-trial motion that said unclean hands, I can't off the top of my head. But
so for us to determine that the district court erroneously failed to incorporate an unclean hands analysis, we would essentially be saying the district court should have spotted an argument that wasn't precisely presented to it.
First of all, I want to be clear. I don't recall offhand whether or not that language was used. And so,
yeah, I'm assuming for the sake of my, yeah,
so, we'll assuming for the sake of argument, I would say, regardless of whether the court characterizes it as unclean hands or not, it's a doctrine within equity. And we are talking about operating in an equitable arena.
Right. Well, the resolution of a trust is within equity.
Correct.
But why would you then assume an unclean hands challenge is a more specific direction for the district court and analyze the general principles of equity under a specific theory of equity.
I would say that you don't need to invoke the doctrine of unclean hands to get to the equitable consequence of the delay caused by the respondent should not result in harm to the appellant. Whether you invoke that with the unclean hands doctrine or not, I don't think for our jurisprudence matters. And again, I do not recall offhand whether or not the words unclean hands was used to the district court or not. I recognize that I've got a very limited period of time. I want to speak briefly to the other two issues, one of which is the distribution of the funds. And I will say that all three issues, I think, ultimately tie into this idea of equitable relief. A farmhouse is an example of one where the evidence was clear that Sydney Start was residing at this, that this was a household for her, and yet that did not factor in.
How do you reconcile that argument with the district court's finding that most of your client's testimony was simply unbelievable? So, which I would assume include part of the testimony that supposedly your client was living there.
So I recognize the district court made that finding, and I recognize that you aren't able to, that this court is not going to overlook that finding. However, I will say that I don't think that there was any absence, that there was no evidence to the contrary. There was no evidence that the respondent was the one who was living at this property or anything like that.
Let's assume that's so. The trust instrument itself directs an equal distribution.
Yes.
Not a distribution that's based on feeling. The district court interpreted it as a financial directive. Why was the district court wrong or clearly erroneous or abusing its discretion in determining that is what the settlor intended?
Because the overall structure of the trust and the duty of the instrument was to result in an equitable distribution of property. And by awarding the farmhouse to somebody who was not in state,
right,
never
well,
lived
to,
there.
One way to determine equity is equal cash value.
I would disagree that is the way that we should look at it and think about it. I think that the equity of who's living there, who is this going to impact, is part of that calculation.
I understand
has
that.
To be considered.
I understand that argument. What I'm trying to figure out is there language in the trust instrument itself that incorporates that theory so clearly as you've made it in your well-reasoned argument?
And I would say that there is language in the trust that does talk about equality, and that is in that and the document, the trust document, has to be read as a whole.
And as we read it as a whole, what language in the trust document would suggest this more equitable distribution based upon feelings of attachment to real property?
Based upon feelings of real property, no, but it does speak about equity. I recognize my time has expired, and I will give you that site when I come back.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Steve Siddick. I represent the respondent, Lisa Start Kalilian, in this matter. I'd like to address some of the questions the court had, but I'd like to just have a preliminary statement, if I may. The court should affirm the trial court's rulings in all respects because the trial court did not abuse its discretion in any manner. The trial court made findings that were all supported by evidence, properly applied the law, and none of the findings were contrary to logic or the facts in the record. We're giving the trial court extreme deference here. The record is reviewed in light most favorable to the court's judgment, especially with respect to the court's judgment regarding witness credibility, which is imperative for the issues, at least two of the issues we're talking about, actually all three. The Nielsen versus City of St. Paul case, I think that we highlighted in our brief, is instructive with respect to the standard that the court should apply. I would urge the court to read the cited portions there. There's three issues we're talking about here: the value of the property, is whether the court erred in valuing the Florida property on Thelma's date of death based on the second appraisal, whether distributing the Minnesota property in consideration of the court's equal distribution was an abuse of discretion, and also whether denial of attorney fees was an abuse of discretion. There was a lot of questions and discussion earlier about language in the trust and the specific language of the trust and how there's this overarching trust instruction to distribute the trust equitably. That's not what the trust says. In fact, specifically what the trust says is laid out in Trial Exhibit 7, that is Carmen Start's trust. They're mirror images. Carmen and Thelma Start's were mutual mirror images of each other. That is Section 6G. And what happens with respect to the trust assets is upon the death of the later to die between Carmen and Thelma, all of the trust assets are to be distributed in equal shares to my daughters. It doesn't say to be distributed in equitable shares. There's nothing in the trust that says anything about equitable distribution of trust assets upon final distribution, because there's nothing there. And there's a difference between equity and equitable. And I think it's very important here, because the appellant's arguments are based on these claims of equitable considerations, which I agree would consider claims of attachment to property or a party's relative means. But that's not what the trust says. Equal means treating everyone the same. Equitable means treating people fairly based on their individual circumstances to achieve equal outcomes. Neither Carmen nor Thelma in their trust said the trust assets should be distributed equitably. They said the trust should be distributed equally. And the whole reason we got to the trial court and the whole reason we're here now is
Would it have been possible to distribute the shares equally even if Mr. Hansen's client got the Minnesota property and the Florida property?
Yes.
Okay.
Certainly would have been. The court could have gone down the trust asset list and seen and divided them up based on numbers, and that's exactly what she did in her amended findings. You can see they're exactly identical. It doesn't get more equal than the findings that the court made. The court definitely could have done that as an equal distribution property, but it did not.
So it sounds like you're saying the court could have done both.
It could have.
Equal and equitable.
Well, no. I think the court could have equally distributed the property by giving Cindy Start the Minnesota and Florida properties, assuming that the rest of the assets would have balanced out equally. But what the court didn't do is award Cindy Start we've been using first names in this case because there's so many starts.
That's fine.
Like a lot of these trust cases. And I think Judge Conley hit the nail on the head. I mean, Ms. Start, Cindy was on the stand, and I think she would, you can look back at the record, but I think I counted 9 times when she was impeached about her testimony with respect to her alleged ties to the Minnesota property. She just wasn't credible. And there was testimony at the trial court. Cindy was living in the Minnesota property because she decided she wanted to live there. There was no agreement for her to live there. No one consented to her living there. There was no lease for the Minnesota property. She simply exercised self-help, changed the locks, and moved to the Minnesota property. In any event, the distribution, what the appellant, Ms. Start, wants you to do now with respect to the Minnesota property is they want you to substitute the trial court, your judgment for the trial court's judgment. And of course, that's not proper, at least with respect to credibility of witnesses. There were some questions about the timing of the sale and repeated allegations about unlawful conduct and unjust enrichment. I can tell you the answer to your question, Judge Ross. The first time the concept of unjust enrichment was raised was in post-trial motions with respect to appellant's argument that she should be entitled to attorney's fees from the trust. That's the first time that word came up. Now,
What about unclean hands?
Unclean hands. That's where it came up. It was in the context of the claim for attorney's fees. There's been a lot of discussion here about this deliberate attempt to drive up the price, these findings of bad faith conduct on my client's part with respect to the Florida property. Those aren't anywhere in any of the findings. The specific finding is that she intentionally did not sell the property, Florida property, to Ms. Lisa Start when she requested. That's true. She didn't. Because there was a significant factual dispute surrounding the Florida property about whether or not Cindy Start breached the lease by unilaterally making improvements to the property. There was significant factual disputes about the validity of the exercise of the option based on evidence that showed Cindy Start had violated the lease based on her conduct at the property, including making unauthorized improvements, including not insuring the property, subjecting the trust to extraordinary liability because there were animals in the street. A donkey got hit by a car on Ms. Start's watch when she was supposedly tasked with taking care of the Florida property, right? But according to her testimony, she moved to Minnesota to the farmhouse before she even signed the lease for the Florida property and stayed there the entire time. The point is there were significant factual issues. Cindy Start made a motion in August. That was the ruling in August. If you look at Index number 246, She made seven motions to force the farm sale, find that she wasn't in breach of the lease, find that the price should be the First Amendment, or first appraisal. And the trial court denied all those motions and said, look, there are significant factual issues here that may show that Lisa Start was, it was appropriate for her to not sell the property. So we're going to determine that on at trial, which the court did and said, yes, we intentionally failed to sell the property. That is true. There was no finding that Lisa Start, as trustee, acted in bad faith or otherwise did something unlawful to try to increase the price, artificially inflate the price of the property. There's no findings that support that argument because it didn't happen. With respect to the valuation of the property, there are two competing appraisals. One of the arguments is that the court clearly erred in accepting the first appraisal based instead of the second one. The court made extensive factual findings about why she chose the second appraisal and why it was more valid. Those are in the addendum, pages 29 and 30.
I mean, that may be so. But in effectuating the intent of the settler, I'm looking at the language of the trust. It seems pretty clearly to direct an early sale related to the time of death.
That
didn't happen here.
Sure. So that is exactly right. So that language is in the lease, and that lease was not written by either one of the decedents. It was not written by the settlors of the trust. It was written by the trustee and the lawyer who was purported to represent the trust at the time. So that did not reflect the settlor's intent. The idea was that it was intended that the closing would occur within 7 months. The language isn't great. It says intended that the closing shall occur within 7 months of date of death.
Does the lease have any language in it that says, you can't exercise the option if you're in default in the lease or if you breach the lease? Is there anything like that?
No, there's not. There's not. But the argument that we made at the trial court that the court rejected was that the breach of the lease meant it was breached and the lease did not apply on the date of the first breach. The judge rejected that argument. So the lease does contemplate that the sale would occur and the closing would occur within 7 months of the date. It was intended that that would happen. That didn't happen. And what the trial court ruled in rejecting appellant's argument that this timing issue was that, the trial court's main objective here was to determine what was the price of the property at Carmen's date of death. Again, first names. That was the main objective. And, of course, that's accurate because the court shouldn't have been caught up in this. I guess I'll call it a technical argument about the timing of this second appraisal that happened within a month after Carmen's date of death, and that the court found more accurately reflected the value of the property on Carmen's date of death. Again, to address one of the questions that the court raised, there was nothing in the lease that required timing of appraisal or evaluation of the appraisal. The only language about valuating the property was that the property should be valued at Carmen's date of death. I think I've addressed the Minnesota property issue. And again, I think here what we're hearing the appellant argue is the same thing she argued below, is that, giving her the farmhouse in addition to the Florida property would be, a more equal distribution of the trust assets as opposed to an equal distribution. The trust doesn't require equitable distributions or more equal, so those arguments should be rejected.
Can you address the issue of the denial of fees?
Sure. So when it comes down to the determination of whether to award fees is ultimately vested in the pure discretion of the trial court, whether it's by statute or by common law. That's what the case law says. You decided the Lund case, and also the Supreme Court decided the Lund case. The 501c-709 with respect to expenses, supplements the common law, which comes down to the trial court has the authority and discretion to award fees or not. So under if we go back, there are two statutes that apply, 501c-1004. The trial court has absolute discretion to award fees. 501c-0709, the trial court shall award expenses properly incurred in administration of the trust. So What the court said here ultimately is that the court made some pretty harsh findings with respect to both parties because my client, Lisa Starr, did not request her fees from the trust. Cindy did. And what the court found in denying the request was supported by the evidence and cited in the record. Both parties pursue litigation for the purpose of serving their own best interests as beneficiaries, not as trustees working on behalf of the trust interest. The court also found, based on evidence presented at trial, we had thousands of pages of spending from account records showing what we contended were improper spending and abuse of trust assets by Cindy. And the court found that the parties, both parties, grossly mismanaged trust assets through avoidable litigation, excessive, wasteful, and self-serving spending. Now, the court didn't...
These are the trips and the hotel bills.
Correct.
And fancy meals.
Yeah, and there's more. I mean, there's more than that. There was just withdrawals from the trust accounts, significant spending, paying for... Cindy Starr paid for, gave money to her sons for various things. What the court basically said was that she interpreted the trust to say that she was not allowed to analyze that spending based on the language of the trust, so didn't get to it. But she said that she wasn't going to award Cindy fees or anyone else based on the conduct that she saw at the trial. And I think that's a proper exercise of the court's discretion in denying fees. The idea now, they're sort of, now the claim has been narrowed down, right? The claim at first was you should award Cindy all of her fees for everything at the trial. And then it was, well, maybe just you should award her fees for defending this, her claim to the Florida property. And then it was, well, maybe you should just give her the fees for, Paul Sween's attorney's fees. So we get more narrow and narrow, more and more narrow issue. And they're based on arguments that the appellant has made. Again, you know, casting these aspersions that just aren't in the record at all. That my client, the claim is that she breached her fiduciary duties of loyalty and impartiality, and that's a legal conclusion. That's at the appellant's brief at page 30, and there's not a finding anywhere in any factual finding, any conclusion of law that my client breached any duty. It just isn't there. This argument that Cindy Starr was forced to litigate this case, the judge rejected that in the trial court level because no one was forced to litigate this case except for my client, who was forced to bring the issue of distribution of the property to the court's attention because the trustees couldn't agree on an equal split. So I think the court's findings in exercising, Judge Martinez in exercising her considerable discretion here, it was appropriate for her to deny fees to Ms. Starr. And I think I'm out of time, so unless anyone has questions.
Well, indeed. Seems to be no further questions from the panel. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
Counsel for appellant.
Thank you. Again, Eric Hansen on behalf of the appellant. I want to start briefly with the question we left hanging. Article 6J, I think, supports, and that was what we cited in our brief, as the provision in the trust that provides for equitable and equal, that tension. I think it's important.
The language that do you have the language?
Sorry, I did, and now I've set it aside because I was moving on to something.
Okay, you've
else.
Got 5 minutes, so I won't waste your time. We'll get the site.
I think that there was an important concession made here at argument, which is that this could have been done equally and equitably, and it wasn't. It was done equally, and I believe our case law, from a 10,000-foot view, is what is the point of what we're doing here? It's a trust. It is a trust to devise assets to children. And there is language in that trust document that specifically talks about it not needing to be monetarily equal. That's the 7J, and I apologize that I don't have the exact language, but that's what it talks about.
But, I mean, let's say we agree with you. The whole point of the equitable distribution of the Minnesota farmhouse was that your client, for all of those reasons, you know, she spent her summers there, she has a personal attachment to it, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But that all depends on whether that testimony was credible, which the court found it wasn't. So therefore, we don't have to get to any of that because the court didn't believe that your client had any great attachment to the Minnesota property. Therefore, it was not inequitable not to give it to her. Now, why am I wrong?
I would submit that the court made a much broader finding than the specific finding that you're saying about regarding the Minnesota farmhouse. I think that in general, the court found her testimony to be largely not credible. Okay. My point is that I think that the district court erred in at least walking through the analysis. I think that the court had an obligation to say there is an argument made here that distribution of the farmhouse is inequitable. The court rejects that argument because, for example, the claim ties to Minnesota are inequitable.
So we should remand this for even more findings?
Respectfully, yes. I think that...
And more generation of attorney's fees for both sides?
Fair point, Judge, and I think, you know, when I read this to the...
Which would diminish the trust assets?
It would diminish the trust assets, but you also have a question of what's the point of this trust document?
How do you ascertain that? I think the language you're pointing to regards distributing income in principal.
It does.
Right?
Yes.
It's not what we're talking about.
It is not specific as to some of the distribution of assets, but I think that taken as a whole...
When you say taken as a whole, you mean taking differently from what it says, which is income and principal. You're talking about the decision as to who receives the house.
I don't think that you can... The trust document did not say specific property to specific people. It directed the trustee to divide it. And so then the question...
Equally.
Correct.
And income and principal equitably.
And I think that language suggests that the intent is that if you could divide the assets equally and equitably, that you ought to.
That's one interpretation of it.
And that's the interpretation that I think is the correct interpretation.
But it's not the only interpretation.
It is... not the only interpretation. I think that to do otherwise does ultimately violence to our concept of what we're trying to accomplish with an estate plan. But
in all fairness, what we're trying to accomplish with regard to an estate plan probably doesn't involve fighting in the Court of Appeals over things that the parents thought would be a nice thing to leave for their children.
I don't disagree. I have never had a estate fight that I think the parents would have been proud of, and this one's included. That's the nature of our system.
True.
And I think that the question that this court has to answer is, what guidance do you give to the district court on this? And I think the appropriate guidance is, if you can do it equitably and equally, you should. And I think that for the reasons regarding the appraisal, for the reasons regarding the distribution of the farmhouse, and for the issue of the attorney's fees, I recognize the court said kind of pox on both your houses, that the court should not have glossed over these issues, and that it's important for this case and for other cases that these principles of both equity and equality be applied. And so we're asking that it be remanded as a consequence.
Thank you. And thank you to both counsel for your... excellent briefing and your very fine oral arguments today. Both clients should be proud of the representation that they've received and happy with it. Nicely done. These cases always trouble me as the father of children who might get property one day. I hate to see them in court.
The solution, Judge Ross, is to spend it all.
spend it all. Now, we're going to issue our decision. We're going to choose who wins or loses. There's nothing that prevents the parties from deciding, you know, let's reach an agreement before we even hear from the Court of Appeals. And so if we hear from you that you've passed an olive branch and reached an agreement, we'd be happy to dismiss the appeal. But If not, we will issue our opinion within the statutory period. The matter is submitted, taken under advisement. Have a great day. Thank you.